Okay, everybody. Hello. I want to welcome to our first teletown hall for Assembly District 76. I want to thank you for joining us, and my name is Tasha Bruno-Horva. It's an honor to serve as the Assembly Member for Encinitas, Carlsbad, Oceanside, Vista, and Camp Pendleton. You know, I think to start this off, when I first took office, I never thought I would be leading during a worldwide pandemic. And the governor, as you know, declared a state of emergency due to the coronavirus in early March. And I was proud that I voted to fund $1.1 billion for California's coronavirus response. It is reassuring to know that this is, and I think this is really important, that it was absolutely bipartisan, unanimous from both houses. So I think all levels of government, both sides of the aisle, are really working together to make sure to keep Californians as safe and healthy as possible. We need to fundamentally shift how we live and work in order to flatten the curve and save lives. And the good news is, and I think we could talk about that a little bit today, it seems like it's working. But I know from all the calls we're getting to my assembly office that many of you have questions about the coronavirus and how you can keep yourselves and your loved ones healthy and safe during this outbreak. So today I'm happy to be joined by some local experts to help answer some of these many questions for my constituents. Our medical expert today is Dr. Will Tseng, Doctor of Internal Medicine, and he's speaking today on behalf of the San Diego County Medical Society. We also have our behavioral health expert is Dr. Dave Folsom, Vice Chair of Clinical Affairs in the Department of Psychiatry, at UC San Diego Health. And our expert to talk to us about the local response and resources available from San Diego County is Carolyn Smith, Office of Strategy and Intergovernment Affairs at the County of San Diego. So before I get started, I wanted to let everybody who's listening in know how our teletown hall works. Each of our experts will talk a little bit about their role in addressing the coronavirus and a few of the common questions they're hearing in their respective fields. Afterwards, I will ask some of the questions that you, our listeners, have submitted via email. You can still submit those questions right now live, and you'll need to, and please take a pen and pencil because my last name is very long. You'll need to submit them to assemblymember.bernerhorvath, BOERNERHORVAVH, at assembly.ca.gov. That's assemblymember.bernerhorvath at assembly.ca.gov. You can still submit those questions as we're going. And to make sure our panel is heard by everyone, all the listeners are on mute, which is the listen mode, and this call is being recorded so people can listen and share it afterwards. If your question is not answered today, my staff will follow up with you directly. And we're also going to have a number of teletown halls on different topics. So if you ask a question not related to the virus or the county response, today we'll probably save those questions for a future town hall. So I'm going to let our experts introduce themselves, tell you about their backgrounds and expertise and how they're helping with in response to the COVID-19 outbreak. So I'm going to start with you, Dr. Will Tseng.
Great. Thank you very much. So my name is Will Tseng. I'm an internal medicine doctor practicing in the hospital mainly. I've been in San Diego for about 20 years, and I was the past president of the Medical Society and currently sit on their executive board. I'm also the board of trustees at the California Medical Association. So thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to talk to the community, to keep the community informed, because really communication and understanding of what this disease is about and how we deal with it is really the best way to combat this virus. So thank you.
Yes, and so Dr. Folsom?
Thank you. Yeah, my name's David Folsom. I am a psychiatrist. I work at UC San Diego. And, you know, we have been closely involved in preparing for some of the mental health outcomes that and fallout that's going to happen as a result of COVID. And so I hope to spend a little bit of time today talking about what people can do to maintain their mental health during this time of great stress, and that would apply both to people who typically don't get any mental health treatment, and then also especially for people who do get mental health treatment and what they can do to make sure that their mental health treatment continues and they continue to stay well.
Perfect. And now Carolyn Smith.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Caroline Smith, and I'm the Interim Director of Strategy and Intergovernmental Affairs with the county for our emergency response purposes. I am part of the policy group of the Incident Command Structure at our Emergency Operations Center.
So you're a person that is like the point person on everything going on in the county. You know, I have the inside scoop, so that's great. Let's start with you, Caroline. Could you give us an overview of how the county has evolved its response to the coronavirus and what folks can expect in the coming weeks?
Absolutely. So we began back by declaring a public health emergency on Valentine's Day, actually, which was February 14th, and that was in response to flights coming in as the federal government's response to certain cruise ships carrying the COVID-19 that were being quarantined at Miramar. So that was before the community spread. And so as things certainly moved across the country and across the world, that response changed significantly. Because we are both at the county, the region's operational area response, we're in charge of the response for the emergency services, as well as the region's public health entity. We've combined all of that response, and we operate our emergency operations center at a level one, which is the highest level. So we have a coordinated disaster response, as I mentioned, as part of the incident command structure. And so that is how we operate all day, every day, 7 days a week, and looking at various components of the response. Certainly our epidemiology department from our public health is out there on the front lines in terms of the case numbers and the case investigations of those that are positive, looking into those clusters. And then we have a host of other folks that are a part of the emergency response. We have a homeless component where we're following the CDC guidelines, getting out porta-potties and hand-washing stations to those folks, those groups of folks that are less than 10, providing hotel rooms for any vulnerable folks that are ill, have tested positive, or who are symptomatic, being able to get them into hotel rooms. And that's not just for the homeless. That could be for a first responder or a healthcare provider that can't safely quarantine or isolate at home. And so we have those folks working on our care and shelter branch on a variety of components at all times. And then certainly we have the communication component, wanting to get that message out there to the public and to our partners. We have weekly sector calls with faith-based organizations, schools, businesses, city managers from all of our local cities and community-based organizations to be able to talk about the issues related to the disaster that impact them specifically. And then we also do our daily press briefings at 2:30. And then our website, which has our data updated every single day, which is coronavirus-sandiego.com. So any stats that you need, you can find there. So that is kind of our response in a nutshell from an overview. And just a huge thank you to Assemblymember Verna Horvath and her team, who are incredibly engaged with us. And I speak to Heather on her team often, and we really appreciate the support and the constant communication.
Great. Well, we always try to be responsive, and I think now we've been I've been personally very impressed with the county's response. Could you say something to the folks who've seen the county's policies evolve, right? We had first gathering ban on groups of 250 more, and then 100 more, then it was, you know, went down to 10, and now I think just yesterday you issued a ban on any gatherings outside of the household unit. Could you make a comment on how you're making those decisions and help people understand who maybe aren't in the know so much, why these things are evolving and what's the goal there?
Absolutely. And so it starts out kind of as a moving target, but certainly in consultation with our epidemiologists and our public health officials who, you know, track infectious diseases all of the time, but that aren't this visible, influenza among them. And so deferring to their, you know, what they call NPIs, and I think some of the physicians on the phone can speak to that, but non-pharmaceutical interventions and limiting that social or that public interaction, that physical interaction is certainly one of them. So the constant goal is to flatten the curve. And so when we look at places like New York or Louisiana or Detroit who didn't get that opportunity, that is something that we wanted to jump in front of. And so as numbers continue to climb, as community rate of spread continued to climb, we needed to make those gatherings smaller and smaller and smaller. And so the rate of community transmission is really what dictated what that looked like and how fast we were doing those orders. And of course, once we got kind of that stay-at-home order in place from the governor, it really helped define and look at where we needed to tighten up some of our local orders to make sure that folks were adhering to the public health orders that were put in place. And we are incredibly proud of our region and our San Diegans who have risen to the occasion and stayed home to keep their loved ones and their community safe. But there are still those folks that think it doesn't apply to them and that they need to, and then they, you know, we're still going out, still having interaction. And in order to keep the public safe and to stop that community rate of spread, those were those reasons the order went into place.
Great. Thank you, Caroline. Next question is for Dr. Singh. How can people, so there are lots, we have a lot of constituents who will call me or call my team, and they'll start describing symptoms to them. And then I remind them I am not a doctor. So there are people who have questions about how can they differentiate between the symptoms of COVID-19 or just a regular cold or a flu or a bronchitis? What should folks be really looking for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I get asked that question all the time. How do I tell if it's any different? So, you know, from our learnings from the data from China and also from New York, the top three symptoms are fever, dry cough, and fatigue. So fever occurs about 87% of the time, dry cough about 70%, fatigue about 38%, and sputum production is 33.4%. So we know those data as hard facts. Shortness of breath plays in as the next one, and then nasal congestion and diarrhea are very, very low on the list, even though we start hearing them. Now, if you compare this to the flu or even cold, it's very, very similar. It is very tough to tell. So what we do is we always ask people to give us a call so we can screen to see if there's exposures at risk. And then from there, you know, we can kind of figure out, is this something that's going to require you to be seen in the hospital, or is this something that you can take care of at home? What we would recommend, even if you have a mild fever, a lot of these can be handled over the phone, and a lot of these, by being quarantined, you can have the problem resolved within 2-3 days. Now, 80 to 87% of the time, you really don't need to end up in the hospital, and we hope that you don't. So these are things that you look for. Now, they're very similar, like I said, to influenza, the adenovirus, the rhinovirus. So the best thing to do is if and when you have symptoms, give us a call. We are testing. There's quick tests that turn around less than 24 hours, and now we're coming up with tests that you can get within a couple hours. So we're getting there, but it is almost impossible for someone to say, well, I think this is the flu. You've got to check in with us. Give us a call. We should be able to take care of it for you.
And when you say we, you don't mean the San Diego County Medical.
So no,
you
no.
Say
any,
we
any,
by calling your doctor, right?
Correct.
Or your telehealth provider.
Correct.
Or whatever you have through your.
Yes, I'll tell you, we have a very coordinated system. So all the big health plans, all the hospitals are talking, the CMOs, the medical officers are talking to each other. We're sharing information. We're collaborating, communicating. The CEOs are also communicating on a weekly, if not biweekly basis. So we all understand that this is a team effort in order to combat this thing, and that you can't tell alone that, hey, this is or is not. What we do recommend is if you have fevers that last, meaning fever over 100.5, that lasts for more than 4 days, you really should consider coming to the hospital to be seen. But if it's fever for one day and goes away with Tylenol and it resolves on its own, then that's something that could be taken care of at home. With just quarantine and isolation.
That's great. So you brought up testing, but I'm going to go to Dr. Folsom first, and then we'll come back to the testing questions, because we do get a lot of questions about that too. Dr. Folsom, what can people do to mitigate the anxiety and depression around this whole pandemic situation. You know, I know some people in my family have anxiety just about, you know, being part of that percentage that ends up in the ICU. Some, you know, I've heard some from some folks about depression because they're alone and they're self-isolating. And especially for those people who are quarantined or sheltered in home place, what advice do you have? What should people be doing to really keep the most positive mental and physical health during this time?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, at my house, we've got, you know, three of my kids who are in their early 20s or late teens who are, you know, at home with us, as well as myself and my wife. And keeping people occupied is a big challenge. We all miss going out and seeing our friends and doing our regular activities. So that makes it hard. I think the stress of the unknown about coronavirus, how long it's going to last, makes it more difficult. And for some people, they've had some very real financial impacts that are challenging too. So a couple of general rules that I think are really helpful. One is if you are a person who'd been getting some kind of mental health care for depression or anxiety, keep getting that care. Keep taking whatever treatment, whatever medications, whatever therapy you are doing, keep doing that. Most medical providers, most therapists, most psychiatrists are now able to provide that care by telehealth, you know, video visits. We've done a big expansion of the video visits at UC San Diego, and they've been going very well. About 80% of all the patients we see in the past 2 weeks are done by a video visit. So that's working really nicely. So keep getting the care you always get. I think that's important. And for everyone else, some general rules. Be careful about not drinking too much. I mean, this is a time when people can isolate, and if you know, drinking has been an issue for you before, it could get worse. Same with you know, overuse of recreational drugs. I mean, I think this is a time to be really mindful about what you're doing and being careful to avoid some bad habits that can make things worse. We also recommend that people are really thoughtful about how much social media and how much news they take in. Reading the newspaper, watching the news, you know, getting a lot of news from the internet can feel pretty overwhelming. So each person has a different kind of threshold for how much of that they should do. And too much of that can be difficult. I know certainly that's something that all of us in my house, each of us has a different amount that we can tolerate or that beyond which it's not helpful. And so we're being really thoughtful about that. Getting out and exercising, some kind of exercise, whether it's setting up a gym in your house to do some kind of exercise, taking a walk early in the morning by yourself, things like that can really be helpful. And then keeping connected with your family and with your friends. If you can't see them in person, talking to them on the phone, doing FaceTime visits, things like that can be helpful. I know some friends and I had a Zoom poker game last weekend that was it's not as good as the real thing, but it was really nice to reconnect with people that, you know, I felt like I hadn't seen for a while. And so those kinds of things, really staying in touch with people as best you can be very helpful.
That's great. So get out and exercise alone safely while social distancing. If you're taking medication for any mental health issues, keep doing that. Keep doing your telehealth with your therapist, making sure that you're staying connected with family and friends, and keeping yourself occupied. We know this is only a limited amount of time, and these are some really good pieces of advice, Dr. Folsom. I think everybody can follow. I know we're following them in our house. So we have about 100 board games, and so we're on, I think, the 50th board game so far. So the next question is about testing that was brought up earlier. I get a lot of questions about testing. Some people are, if they have, because Dr. Singh, you were saying, it's kind of hard for the average person to differentiate, you know, if it's coronavirus or a cold or the flu. Can someone with mild symptoms get tested? And if so, where do they go? Okay. And there's this all this conversation on the news about expanding testing capacity. Dr. Singh, you mentioned like the 24-hour test, the quick test. I keep hearing in the news sources I'm connected with that there's going to be a 5-minute blood test. Can you speak to any of the stuff on testing? And after Dr. Singh, if anybody else wants to weigh in on what maybe the county is doing for testing sites, that would be helpful.
Sure. One general rule is that tests are being more and more available every single day. So when we started this whole process, we had one test that's made by Quest. And then as things went on, which took usually about 4 days at that time to get the response back, then we started getting the Roche test, which it was a 24-hour turnaround. Now we have an Abbott test, which can turn around. They say it's about 14, 15 minutes, but actually, practically, last time I did it, just today, it was about 2 hours. But what the main thing is that every big, large organization has the Abbott test in their place now, so everybody's being able to test. Now, the question that I get the most is, well, why should we test everyone? Here's the problem. When you're exposed to the time you get symptoms, it's about 5 to 7 days. If you test too early when you're asymptomatic, you're going to get a false negative because the virus hasn't gone into you yet and it hasn't expressed itself yet, which we call viral shedding. So if you test too early without the symptoms, you may get a false negative test. Then you go out thinking everything's normal and you spread it more. So the best time to test is really when you're symptomatic. The second issue is if, let's say, you're symptomatic but it's very mild, again, we don't know if you're going to get a false negative or not. And that false negatives can be an issue in terms of containing this virus. So it's really if you have the fever, you have the cough symptoms, and you have exposure, then that's really a good way or a strategic way of testing rather than just testing everybody before they have symptoms. So we're getting more and more every day. More and more people are getting tested, but we got to test wisely as well.
And so where would people go if they want to get tested? They could go to their doctor, right? I know some of our hospitals have also like the drive-through tents where you don't have to get out of your car and they'll test you. But if people want to go get tested, does anybody have advice? And I'm opening up to the group on where should people go? What's the best path to make sure you're judiciously testing people, but your people have access?
I think definitely call your doctor first because there are a lot of drive-through testing sites available and also in the hospital, every hospital, they have testing available inpatient. So I would say call them first because what we can do is, again, you don't want to just walk into the emergency room with these symptoms or else you probably knocked out a whole team there. So, again, give us a call for – give your primary care physician a call first before just showing up.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Dave. Can I add just a little bit? I think that was a great description. And I know we've been every system is working on this. For people who are connected to get their health care in a larger healthcare system, whether that's UCSD or Scripps or Kaiser, I think all of those places have worked out some really good systems, oftentimes with like a nurse advice line that people can call first. I know certainly that's what we have. And then they'll help direct you. Testing is much more available now than it was even a week ago. And I think that's great because people had to be pretty sick and pretty symptomatic and really hospitalized to get tested last week, and it's better now. And I think that's people are really appreciating the fact that being tested is a lot easier. And it's hard because really the only definitive way to know whether you have it or not is to get tested. People who are not part of a larger health system, definitely the best way to go is to their primary care doctor and talk to them, and oftentimes they will have worked out arrangements to get this testing done.
Great. Caroline, do you want to add anything on countywide testing or test results or anything like that?
Sure, absolutely can. And just to echo what both of the other speakers said, and we do have some obviously availability to test through the public health lab. Those tests do require a healthcare referral, though, a physician referral. So echo 100%, you know, getting that referral from your primary care physician who can assess that need. And just from capacity, because we get that question a lot from the region. Currently the county's public health lab, as was mentioned earlier in the very beginning of this, there was the one test, and it was the issue of the availability and the reagents and things like that. And so our region collectively, public health, hospitals, healthcare systems, and cooperation with commercial labs work to stand up other platforms. And so currently we have two testing platforms at the county's public health lab with a third coming online hopefully in the next couple weeks. We have 7 hospitals that have the capability of running their own tests and 4 commercial labs. And then today we added one of our federally qualified health centers also has the ability to do their tests on site. And so the capacity in our region compared to other places is actually pretty good. And so we feel good about that, of course, always continuing to work for more platforms, but definitely want to direct folks to their primary care providers to get those referrals if they feel they need to be tested.
Thank you. And I think you all have brought up a really important point and different answers that you said that I really want my constituents to know. I talk every day with other legislators throughout the state. And one thing that's phenomenal about San Diego County is the way in which our public health teams, whether it's, you know, the private hospitals or the public hospitals or the district hospitals or the county, are working together to address this is quite unique and it's very robust. So I feel that we have had really appropriate responses from the county, very, very timely responses in line with federal and state guidelines. I also feel that everybody is working together, and that is not always the case in other parts of our state. So commendation to all of you and the organizations that we have for the good work that you're doing. So for the next question, and I'm going to see who wants to answer this. I don't know if it's Dr. Singh or not. So we had a question about actually the virus being airborne, and we actually know that the virus is not airborne. We know that it's not airborne, but rather transmitted by droplets. What is the difference between a virus being airborne and a virus being transmitted by droplets? And what does that mean for what we're looking for to keep ourselves safe? You know, there's lots of questions up here I see about, you know, you shouldn't be biking next to somebody or biking behind somebody or running behind somebody. There's lots of questions about what are distancing and keeping each other safe. And I think, you know, maybe that's helpful to clarify the airborne versus droplet kind of conversation.
Sure. Droplet precaution means things will settle as a droplet. It's heavier. Whereas airborne are things like TB where they can remain in the air for quite a long time. Now, there are studies where you can look at and that people quote where it's done through a machine. They blow it very hard and they try to do as much as they can to keep it airborne and look to see can it last and how long it lasts. And airborne can last up to 3 hours or so. Droplet usually it settles fairly quickly. And that's why we talk about the 6-foot range. So when somebody sneezes, we usually see about a 3-foot range in sputum or spit, for lack of a better word. So if you double that distance to 6 foot, your chance of getting exposure is much less. It can also settle on tables, so that's why we say wipe your keyboards, wipe your tabletop to make that clean, because it can also sit there for a while as well. So droplet settles faster than airborne, and the precaution is very different in terms of what you require in terms of personal protection equipment, and that plays a part to it as well, but mostly it's because we see that by evidence in Seattle and some New York where people use droplet precautions and have been able to defeat or overcome this virus, the COVID. So droplet settles faster, airborne stays in the air for quite a long time.
Okay, so when we're going out, and that's why we say when you're going on a jog or you're going to go biking, because, you know, as Dr. Folsom said, we should still go out and exercise. That's why we want to keep 6 feet away from each other, right?
Correct.
Because, you know, you want to make sure And that's why we say when we, you know, wash your hands often, you know, wipe down your cell phones. You know, in our house, we wipe down all doorknobs, all light switches, refrigerator handles very often. You know, we wash our hands right when we get home. We unpack the groceries. We wash our hands again. It's a little bit like Lady Macbeth in our house, with how much we wash our hands, but it's better being safe than sorry. That's why we say those things, right? Yeah.
It's the first time that my kids are listening to me and washing their hands. So there's some good that came out of it.
There we go. So the second question, or another question is, people have been asking about what should they be looking about how the coronavirus progresses. What's a typical timeline of symptoms? You already said typically the symptoms start showing up between 5 and 7 days. Can you take us through what a typical coronavirus case looks like, and kind of you had given indication before, at what point should people be going to the hospital?
Sure.
What should they expect at that point if they get into the ICU?
Sure. So the again, if you have fevers and it lasts for more than 4 days, you really should call and talk about being in the hospital, at least to be evaluated in the hospital. Usually what happens once you start getting the symptoms, and again, the big ones are shortness. The big ones are fever, cough, and some shortness of breath symptoms as well. When you come in, what's surprising is that sometimes you don't get low saturation. You don't show up the same way. I mean, you don't have the low saturations. But when we see the fevers or persist, we can treat you with some antibiotics sometimes, supportive care sometimes, oxygen to make sure your body is as healthy to combat this thing as possible. And once you're in the hospital, about 20 to 30% may end up in the intensive care unit. And God forbid, but some people will need ventilation, will need that intubation to keep the airways going and make sure that you get enough oxygenation. Now, the biggest risk factor associated with someone not doing well are cardiovascular disease, diabetes, chronic respiratory disease, high blood pressure, cancer, and then the big one, which is people who are immunosuppressed, so low immune system. Those are the patients that we have to take special care of and actually would report symptoms. I would ask them to report symptoms a little earlier, because if we get to you earlier, we really can make it so that it's less stressful on your body and eventually improve your outcome. But once you get in the ICU, it's usually a longer course. So usually if you get intubated after a couple of days, we can get you off of the machine. With COVID, we don't know exactly why, but it takes a longer course of being on the ventilation before people actually come off. And, you know, we hear good news all the time. Just today we're extubating another two of our patients, and they do well. So it's not as bad. Our statistics are really not as bad as China's, and definitely, definitely much better than Italy. And our mortality rate is lower than both of those countries. So our modern medicine, plus the fact that we have 2 to 3 week lead time on those cities and countries, really puts us in a good position. And I have to give it to you guys, from the city council to the mayor to the assembly member and to our governor, we jumped on this early, which has made all the difference in my point of view in making sure that we come out of this minimally scathed, I guess.
I think that is reassuring to hear that our numbers and our progression and our recovery is much better than other countries, because I hear from a lot of people, that's what people are really afraid of. They see these things on the news, and that's the Dr. Wolfram's point about managing how much news we're taking in. Really, the facts are showing, at least right now, that us flattening the curve is working. That's very reassuring for people to walk away from this call with. And that leads us to the next question. I think this is directed towards Caroline. We keep hearing about flattening the curve. There are different models people are using to judge when the peak is. I know there's a University of Washington study that says the peak is in California something like next week. The California Department of Health has assured us as legislators, not assured us, has told us, us as legislators, it's probably sometime in May. Every county is, though, very different. When I talk to my Bay Area colleagues, they're facing a very, very different situation than we are here in San Diego. So where would you project this to be on that curve here in San Diego County, especially looking at North County? We know a majority of the cases are in the city of San Diego. And when do you expect us to hit the peak?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I would then take all of my luck to Vegas and you know, bet on some roulette wheels. But when it opens back up again. But, you know, you ask a very good question, and we hear about it a lot. And, you know, there's the University of Washington model and the University of Pennsylvania model, and there's a couple of other models. And we actually have a team of epidemiologists that are working on it right now. Because for us at the county level, it's not just theoretical. So there's lots of models online. It's lots, you know, it's kind of nice to plug in the numbers and see where the curves go. But for us, there are some real concrete decisions that need to be made about public health orders and what we're really asking the public to do with that information. And so we really want to make sure that that's correct. One of the things that they all agree on is we don't yet have enough data to say for sure when. We do know that we're having a hugely positive effect with the stay-at-home order and everybody's social adherence to social distancing. What we don't know, because certainly what would happen is if we thought, oh, okay, it's fine, and we gave everybody a date, and then the next day everybody goes out, and then all of a sudden the community transition comes back, and you get that giant second wave that we want to avoid. So it's kind of a complex question, and really one of the things that we looked at with the models was kind of why our supervisors introduced at our press conference the April 30-day challenge, because we think in the next couple of weeks having that data to really look at will give us a really good picture of where we're at. And to really start to see if those numbers, you know, start to decline, if we have a decline in cases, in transmission, and in deaths and in hospitalizations, because certainly the thing we want to avoid is overwhelming our healthcare system.
So what we do know is we're not on the other side of the curve yet. We haven't hit that peak yet. That is something we can say. If you're saying an
Absolutely.
April 30 challenge, we're
yes.
still on
definitely not
the
at the other side
of the curve. Okay, good. I think that's an important thing, you know, because I think a lot of people, you know, my kids are 9 and 12 at home. I've told my kids we're probably staying home to the end of May at least, just to set appropriate expectations. And you brought up a really good point about a second wave. And I know I hear a lot about that, is there's this idea that this is the first peak, and then, you know, maybe in summer it will get better, but then that circulation could cause another peak in the fall. And as somebody with school-age kids, I wonder how that's going to affect education and their learning. Does anybody have any, you know, scientific data? I hear it's not there, but best guesses about how this can circulate? And how does that relate to something like an equivalent of a Tamiflu for the coronavirus coming on the market, or and when we can expect to see a vaccine? Maybe it would be helpful if somebody could kind of give a bigger, you know, 10,000-mile view of what this could look like without creating a lot of fear in people. I don't know if anybody can make a statement to that.
I can tell you that, you know, we started working, as a medical community, we started working on a vaccine right away. And I believe there's in Washington, they have already started a vaccine trial. But to get a vaccine from development, successful testing, and then to production, to implementation, really takes a long time. And I believe Dr. Fauci had said maybe about 18 months or so for the vaccine. But in the meantime, there's some trials in terms of treatment available. But again, they're only a trial basis, so we can't say for sure. But to really get there, the vaccine is really the ultimate treatment for this, and hopefully sooner rather than later, but my guess is going to be not till next year.
Yeah, just to add to it, I think all of us have been, you know, following various outlines of things, and I think there are discussions about having ongoing social distancing precautions that continue. More widespread testing available so that people who have symptoms can be tested quickly and everyone will test positive. we would then be able to do the classic epidemiologic work of also testing all the contacts that they've had, and that will become easier as we get more widespread testing, and several interim steps while we wait for a vaccine, because that is a ways out. And so I think right now the all of these other social interventions are really the mainstay of how we keep everyone safe and slow down the spread.
Caroline, do you want to have a comment about, you know, what should people expect? You know, if we hear the vaccine development may take up to 18 months, what can people expect for the next 18 months?
You know, that's a really good question. And one of the things that the head of our epidemiology group, Dr. Eric McDonald, one of the ways he explained it to us when we were going through our things, and I think mentioned this at a press conference, is one of the things our current social distancing and non-pharmaceutical interventions are doing is allowing us time to build a systems capacity to respond to the virus. So now it's not new. Now we've developed a response plan. We've worked with our hospital partners to know what capacity looks like. The community knows and is educated on how to prevent this. So hopefully, the thought process behind, you know, the epidemiology with it is that any future things that come, those waves would be smaller. They would not be as big. But, of course, that's provided that people don't all rush out, you know, the next day and continue their, you know, parties and things like that. And so those are what factor into the decisions that we make. What I think folks can expect in the future, once we start to come down on the other side of that curve, once the data starts to show us, is it's not going to be, you know, lift the gates and everything's done. What will likely happen is a gradual relaxing of some of those public health orders that are in place to allow things to start coming back slowly so that we don't completely reintroduce the virus into the community and start over from scratch.
I think that's so helpful to so many people. I think people are, you know, I know I've been on a bunch of task forces and people are saying, okay, so summer's going to be here. How do we get tourism back up and how do we do this? And, you know, the part of me that looks at this and says, well, you know, we will have some guidelines to, what did you call it, non-pharmaceutical interventions. That's a lovely, lovely term, going forward in the summer. So I think it's helpful to know and for people to start thinking about, this is kind of a longer way of life until we get that vaccine. So, and maybe not as it is now, but that we all have a lot of individual responsibilities also in the next 18 months to keep our community safe. So I'm going to move to a different conversation, which is about face covering. This has been a very big conversation in my household. And I sew a lot, so I've been looking at different material, and different material have vastly different efficacies in terms of protecting others from ourselves, which I think is the primary benefit of face covering, but also protecting us from others. Does anybody have any insight into what the best material it is for your do-it-yourself face mask, and how effective are those different face coverings for folks?
Well, in the hospital, we have a universal masking where everybody wears a surgical mask. The content of the material, I'm not quite sure. I don't know if there's an N95 material, but what it is anything that will filter out that droplet is what we're looking for. Now, the masking does a couple of things. Psychologically, it also helps you prevent touching your nose and mouth for the contamination, but also it prevents you from expectorating the droplets, and that protects everybody else around you as well. For the healthcare workers, we were asked to put a mask, and if and when, like today when I was seeing the COVID patient, I would have my N95 mask on, and then I had a face shield on and also goggles as well. So those are the way we protect ourselves from the patients, the droplets, but also having the patient wear a mask is also helpful as well. And it doesn't have to be of any specific material, just something that will help prevent the spread. I think that's an important part of it.
That's great. I think that's very helpful because I think some people were looking at it and say, oh, we have to, you know, And I've been telling folks, like, don't try to get surgical masks or N95 masks. We need those for our healthcare workers and our first responders, you know. And so I think we're going to, my office might do a sew-along next week to sew face masks for some of our volunteers in the community. We have some questions from constituents on what to do if one of a member of our household contracts the coronavirus. You know, so if say one of the kids or, you know, say we have a multi-generational household, somebody a little older contracts the coronavirus. What, do you guys have any guidance on how to stay safe with somebody with coronavirus in your household?
I have a couple of things to talk about. You know, actually, I one of my coworkers has been through this as has a good friend. And I think one of the best things to do is that person really needs to be isolated, ideally in a room where they also have a bathroom that only they use, that they're not out and about in the house. They're not in the kitchen making their own food. People kind of bring the food to them. I think with the new masking guidelines, you know, having that person wear a mask anytime they're out of the room, as well as other household members wearing a mask when they're nearby, would be very prudent. And then really careful cleaning of all the surfaces where virus could be is really important. You know, we've talked about that a lot in my family because we have a multi-generation house, and you know, we're taking extra steps to make sure our older family members are really safe. My kids are actually doing a phenomenal job at this. And but it's hard because when people get the coronavirus, they can have a, you know, a moderate case that doesn't require a hospital stay, can still last a couple of weeks, and the person feels pretty miserable for a while. And it's extra hard because really we don't want anyone else near them, so that we really limit household spread. That is definitely one of the challenges they had in Italy early on. And I think it's hard for the person who's sick, and being sick and by yourself really sucks. And it's hard for the other family members who want to be able to kind of be there and provide them with some comfort. And I think the best thing you can do for everyone involved is, you know, be extra careful about maintaining that social distance and find ways that you can keep the person occupied while they're isolated in the house.
Yeah, that's a very good response. I didn't think about keeping them with their own bathrooms, so, you know, limiting the number of surfaces, obviously the cleaning, but that's some very, very good tips for people worried about that at home. We had some questions, and I'm not sure how on the call can answer them. Is it safe to order items online or through a food delivery app or... some companies will deliver to your door. Do we need to clean those or take extra precautions when those packages or groceries come into our home? Do you have any advice on that? Because we know it is droplet transmission. So droplets could, you know, be on the package or be on the contents of that package or be on the gallon of milk that's delivered. What would you tell people?
Yeah, I ask my patients to cook their foods, even if it's delivered. And actually, anything that's hot and warm, that's cooked, I tell my patients to do that. And we try to make it a point to support our local restaurants by actually ordering out. And as long as it's hot food, I think it's okay. I don't know if anybody else has to me.
And then I would say that, you know, at our house, we, again, with a, you know, multi-generation house, whoever goes to the grocery store, we typically have a designated person go to the grocery store. We get something from Amazon. We put it on a table outside and wipe it down before it comes in the house. Is that absolutely necessary? I don't know, but I think it really helps everyone in our house feel good about doing everything they can to keep ourselves healthy. And, you know, for a younger person, COVID is not nearly as dangerous as it is for an older person. And so I think that they really feel like, you know, they're doing the best they can to help their, you know, grandparents stay healthy and get through this.
Yeah, that's That's what I told my mom. I told her she should have a little rag with a light bleach solution and just wipe everything down when it comes
out. Yeah. I mean, we do all the shopping for our, if you can, I mean, it's nice that we do all the shopping for, you know, my parents and my in-laws, and then just deliver the food. And we typically will send just one family member out once a week, you know, try and be much more kind of thoughtful and planful about shopping compared to our, you know, what we would usually do, which is, you know, you'll go to the store almost every day. So, and then wipe stuff down before it comes in the house.
Yeah. Great advice. We have a lot of generous people in their district. They've been generous with donations to nonprofits, but they've also been generous with donations of their time. And they want to go out and volunteer at the food banks or the school meal distribution centers. What advice would you have for those folks who are going out and they're really trying to help others in the community who maybe need to self-isolate at home or are part of a more vulnerable population? What you know, the common things that you can think about to give them some advice on? When you go out and volunteer, these are the five things that you should do.
I would say if you're a vulnerable population, I would not go out and do things. I think you've got to shelter in place. We've had some elderly ladies who've made masks for us. But first off, I just have to thank the community, because the healthcare worker community, we can feel the love and the appreciation, and really keeps us going quite a long way. So I want to first say that. But for the vulnerable population, try to shelter in place. The last thing we want is for people who are vulnerable to get sick, because again, it is a mortality rate is skewed toward the elderly and immunocompromised population. For the ones who do, we received donations in terms of personal protective equipment, like the mask, face mask. We've had people show up with banners and signs and pictures and well wishes. Those are all great. I think that's fine. But again, our best thing that we can receive is that everybody stays healthy. And to do that, you have to follow the county. I mean, the county has done such a great job in getting the message out, making sure that everybody is up to date on what's going on, and that communication and that sheltering in place has really, I am absolutely sure, saved lives to this day. So thank you for everything that's doing. We can feel it. But if you're vulnerable, do not go out.
And I would add, if you're trying to help out vulnerable folks, you know, the key things would be to be really, really kind of fanatical about washing your hands, wearing face covering, things like that, so that you're doing, you know, if you're, you know, delivering groceries to an older person who can't go out and do it themselves, for example, it's a time to be extra careful and conscientious about that. Being really mindful of your own symptoms. If you have any symptoms at all, you really, really don't want to be doing any kind of volunteering. If you have a cough, if you have a low-grade fever, if you have any of these other symptoms, you know, the best thing you can do to help out the people you're trying to help is not volunteer to help them for that period of time. And if you're feeling well, it's really to, you know, be really extra mindful about wearing a mask and washing your hands, and, you know, being careful about what you bring into wherever you're trying to help people, whether it's at a school or especially if you're helping, say, do some meals or grocery shopping for a senior.
That's great advice. We have one final question, and that is, do we have enough hospital beds and ventilators for the peak of this coronavirus epidemic or pandemic?
So I work with the county pretty closely on this, and just to kind of give you a big overall picture, you know, we look at the stuff, we look at the staff, and we look at the structure. So the stuff are the things you're talking about, hospital beds and ventilators and PPE, and then the staff are people who help, and then the structure is what the county has set up. In terms of the stuff, we have about 8,500 beds across the county, and about 850 ICU beds and 600 or 700 ventilators. And as you heard, I think it was Sunday, they're building another 250 beds just in case there's a need. But the county has taken an amazing effort in coordinating this and making sure that all the hospitals are in constant communication and that all the CEOs and the medical officers are really talking to each other so that we can share resources if indeed that's what we need. And if we do that together, we will have enough. Now, I say that only because so far we've done a great job as a community in kind of lowering that trend and bending that curve. If we do not do this, if we do not continue and keep the curve bent, then we may be talking about a mild or severe situation. Right now we're mild. We may be talking about a moderate or severe situation. And when that happens, then we will not have enough. So at this point, I'm fairly confident that it's still a long stretch, but right now we have sufficient, as long as we continue to listen to what you and our county and our governor has been talking about and sheltering in place.
Great. Carolyn, do you want to chime into that? Because I think the county has done an amazing job at coordinating. And as I said earlier, I don't know if every county is really following the San Diego model, which seems to be best practice. Do you think we have enough beds and PPE and ventilators for the peak?
Well, for beds, just to concur with Dr. Tseng said, it does look that way, yes. And that's provided everybody sticks to the current models of social distancing, which is why we try to flatten that curve, because the cutoff of that curve is where we have the available beds. And so it does look like at the rate of transmission and hospitalization right now, at the rate that we're climbing, that yes, on our peak day, we will have enough hospital beds. And so that is the good news, and that is many thanks to the hospital partners and the healthcare systems that worked so quickly to make everything available. And as was mentioned, we have the federal medical station, which is sometimes referred to as the mobile field hospital, which will be set up in the coming, hopefully, week or so on two unused floors of the new Palomar Hospital. So that's good. And as the county, we've been working to procure other buildings, some vacant dorms at UCSD, just in a worst-case scenario type of thing. But it does seem that we will be okay in terms of beds. PPE is a whole different story. That continues to be a tough one, and certainly we know supplies from the national stockpile are going to places like New York and Detroit and other places that really need it, but that continues to be a concern for us. We put in orders continually, and we are getting a slightly less than 20% of the orders that we place on behalf of the region for supplies. So as a county, we are purchasing those supplies on the open market, but of course lots of people are, including the governor, so it's you know, trying to get the best price for those and bringing as many supplies into the region as we can. And PPE is not – a lot of people just think about those N95 respirator masks, but PPE is really a whole protective kit of things that includes gowns and gloves and face shields and things like that. And so we constantly are looking at ways to procure more of those. I think the answer is now the hospital systems are getting what is most essential, but certainly we're not at an ideal level for that, so we continue to work on it, but something that we're focused on every day.
Great. That's a great update. I know we do have a – sorry, Dr.
This more than anything is why we want to bend the curve, because getting these supplies now is hard. Getting these if we can stretch it out over a longer period of time, it becomes much more doable and kind of much less stressful on the whole system.
Exactly. And I think that's a great kind of point to transition to our final comments. I want to thank you all from the bottom of my heart for taking time out of your day to inform my constituents. We have over 100 people on this call, people that are tuning in, really trying to figure out what's going on. And I think this session has been super informative to me, but I think also my constituents. So I'd like to go around our virtual room and offer each of our experts an opportunity for any final remarks that they would like to make before we close out. So, Dr. Singh.
Oh, yes. I think what you've done is a great service to the community. If you can, if people are informed and they know what I know, they will do what I would do, which is really listening to the county and sheltering in place. And that message has, like I said before, saved lives of our neighbors and friends. So I appreciate your doing this.
Thank you. Dr. Folsom?
I think that, the cooperation we've seen all up and down the line from the state to the county to the hospitals has been impressive. I think that should help reassure all of us that San Diego is really doing a fantastic job. It helps lower my stress, and I hope it helps lower the stress of others and the people on this call. It still won't be easy, but I think we're doing a fantastic job.
Great. And Carolyn?
Yes, thank you, just Assemblymember, for your leadership and for your team, and then just thank you to everybody that's on the call. This is not easy. It's not an easy time. It causes a lot of stress, and at best, it's inconvenient. As at worst, it's a huge life change. And thank you for what you're doing to keep the most vulnerable in our community safe. Although, as we've seen, it's not always the most vulnerable. Sometimes, for some unknown reason, this disease and this virus can hit healthy people just as much. So we don't want anyone to have to suffer with this if they don't have to. So just appreciate everyone's efforts to support flattening the curve and following and adhering to those stay-at-home orders.
Yes, thank you. And I want to remind everybody that April is our critical month. My family and I are taking the April 30th challenge. I hope everybody on this call will as well. Please maintain your physical distancing, wash your hands, stay at home. I loved how Dr. Folsom said, they've kind of changed as they've gone out. Their family only sends one person out once a week. That's what we do. I hope everybody else is doing that. And thank you for being here today. This recording will be made available on my Assembly website at a76.asmbc.org. If you have any questions, and not only on the coronavirus, but on any of the economic impacts of your small business, we're going to be doing a number of teletown halls. My office is here to assist you, and that number is 760-434-7605. Watch your inboxes and social media for my next teletown hall, and thank you all so much for joining us today.